5031 with the Department of Human Services, Division of Medical Assistance Programs. And we're here to hear from the public, from you, the public. Thank you very much for being here. First person I'd like to call is Ms. Jenny, Ellie Jenny.
Madam Chair, I have Ms. Jenny's written testimony, which I'll be happy to hand out.
Thank you. Senator Carter and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ellie Jenny, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 5031. I have received Oregon Medical Assistance Program services, or the Oregon Health Plan services, since the Oregon Health Plan began, and longer with OMAP, and am very grateful for the help that comes from these programs. Without this program, I would be dead. Although I have problems with some of the issues surrounding the Oregon Health Plan, I am nonetheless grateful for this program and how it helps me stay alive. Without OMAP, I would be unable to provide for my health care, prescriptions, therapy, surgeries, durable medical equipment, and all the issues of my disability. Around the issue of funding, I do have some concerns with the new health care reform committee, reworking of the Medicaid, the Oregon Medical Assistance Program, the Oregon Health Plan, along with the Medicare program. This may not be the place to air my concerns, but it does have very much to do with what may happen to OMAP and the health care for disabled and senior Oregonians. Although I'm not yet clear on all the details, I am concerned about the composition of who sits on the Oregon Health Fund Board. So far, there is only one position for a consumer, and there is no clarity as to what defines this consumer. Because disabled Oregonians have unusual and chronic health care issues, it is very important in the state's rush to contain costs and expand the health coverage that individuals with disabilities be represented in this process. At this point, I have no assurance of this. I bring this up because I do not want to see disabled Oregonians harmed in the reception of their health care needs, simply so the state can spread health care a little thinner to apply to more Oregonians. I do not mean to sound selfish. I only bring this up because, as it now appears, this seems like what is going to come of the state's effort to serve more and spread the OMAP a little thinner. My life has become much more difficult under the Oregon Health Plan, and I can see it getting even more difficult under this program. Something else that was discussed in the Oregon Medical Assistance Program presentation, I haven't been able to sit in all of them because I've had a kidney infection, and I'm getting better, but not quite. It is the issue that concerns me is the issue of nutrition. That is one thing I have not been able to get any information on, and I believe is a big factor in a recent diagnosis of diabetes. I fought obesity and a lot of things. My doctor couldn't help me, and I was frustrated. I didn't know where to go. And now, because of that, I have this new chronic issue. And right now, I thank you for considering my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions if I can.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morsa.
Thank you. Thank you, Ellie. Thank you for being here. What kind of How would you describe the consumer representative that you would like to see on the board? I mean, consumer covers a lot of area.
I would rather it be, you know, like a disabled advocate, someone who's there living it daily, mm-hmm. who understands the issues. I'm not necessarily volunteering. I'm just saying that someone who's articulate and aware. Mm-hmm. It's just that I don't want all of the issues surrounding the disability and seniors. We all have unique, unfortunately, chronic health care needs, and I just want their voice in the debate, because when it isn't there, then I'm afraid that concerns or their issues, their needs won't get recognized, and I don't want to take away from people having the opportunity to have insurance. I grew up without insurance. I know that it's not easy, but at the same time, I don't want the people, seniors, and I do fit into that category now also, or disabled, to be harmed by the state's efforts to help more.
Okay.
It's just that it's a very broad issue, because disabled people have a lot of health needs that the typical able-bodied Oregonian probably doesn't have or wouldn't even think about. You know, I could tell you a lot of things about me, you know, ostomy supplies, different kinds of prescriptions that I now have problems getting because of the health plan.
I certainly will support your recommendation. What you just said, I will support that.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm Sarah Myers, Judy Fikowski, and Sean Mattson, please.
Oh, I think I got stuck there.
Thank you. The thing is, I'm taking those people who are more than 100 miles away, even though some of you, your name was listed before theirs.
I pointed the arrow at Miss Judy Falkowski from Coos Bay. I was about to state that for the record. My name is Sarah Myers, Executive Director for the Oregon Association for Home Care. With me today are Sean Mattson from Portland, a home health agency, and Judy Falkowski from Coos Bay, who is more than 100 miles away. So thank you for the indulgence.
You bet.
Again, the Oregon Association for Home Care is a statewide organization representing skilled home health, hospice, and in-home care providers. Being passed out to you at the moment is an overview of my testimony, as well as the testimony of Ms. Mattson and Ms. Falkowski. In 1991, the Oregon Association for Home Care solicited the advice of the director for the National Center for Healthcare Law in Washington, D.C., to investigate a possible lawsuit against the state of Oregon on the, quote, state's failure to follow its own Medicaid state plan regarding reimbursement rates to home health care providers. The findings indicated that unless the state remedied this matter, that home health agencies had a viable cause of action for both retroactive and prospective relief. Under federal law, the state Medicaid program must, quote, assure that payments are consistent with efficiency, economy, and the quality of care, and are sufficient to enlist enough providers so that care and services are available under the plan, at least to the extent that such care and services are available to the general population in the geographic area. The advice further indicated that the state had the flexibility to determine the manner in which rates are to be set for Medicaid home health services, and that the payment rate flexibility for home health must be contrasted with the standards affecting hospitals, skilled nursing facilities, and intermediate care facilities, where the state must set rates at a level which is reasonable and adequate to meet the costs which are incurred by an efficiently and economically operated facility. At that time, the Oregon Association for Home Care shared this information, and with the then-director, Gene Thorne, who worked with our organization to ensure that home health rates were based on the Medicare payment methodology as was outlined in the state plan. In 2000, the Oregon Association for Home Care again began conversations and documented meetings in an exchange with the Department of Human Services to address yet another 10 years of rate adjustments not keeping pace with the cost to deliver services, a period notably marked with yet again limited general fund revenues and cost of living adjustments that were taken away as quickly as they were recommended. These discussions resulted in the Home Care Association requesting a budget note to the Department of Human Services 2001 budget, calling for the department to work directly with home health providers to assure the state was meeting its obligations as set forth in the Medicaid state plan by reviewing rates and rate setting, as well as to consider biennial rebasing methodology to ensure that those rates were kept in line relative to the cost to deliver the service. Even with a relatively complete analysis of Medicare cost report data demonstrating costs well in excess of the payment, unfortunately, at that time, only a budget-neutral rate adjustment and no further reconsideration of rate rebasing had occurred. As is customary for building its budget recommendations and on a biennial basis, the department actuary, PricewaterhouseCoopers, analyzed Medicaid home health rates and found that providers were in fact being reimbursed at less than 39% of the cost to deliver the service. In 2006, the actuary issued its analysis again, noting the disparity in cost versus reimbursement for home health care providers. This same report noted that it is the responsibility of the state program to, quote, comply with established guidelines that rates are actuarially sound and cover the cost of providing services, end quote. And that furthermore, the department has a responsibility for ongoing monitoring and updating of the fee-for-service costs. It is recognized and stated.
I hate to interrupt you, but can I have you have, what I want to do is have everybody spend at least 3 minutes so we can give everybody a chance. And so, you've had three, but I'll give you another one since you're...
Okay, thank you. I will wrap that up, Chair Carter. Thank you. My primary points include that we want to assure that the state program affords all providers an equitable reimbursement under the Medicaid state program. At current, it does not. As I indicated, we are being reimbursed at 39% of cost, which has been documented by the state's actuary on numerous occasions. In recent years, the state Oregon Health Plan under standard has eliminated benefits for home health as well as for therapy, which has become another problem. In addition, co-pays under the Oregon Health Plan Plus act as barriers to patients and to providers who must reduce their rates further in order to continue to provide services to these patients. In closing, I would like to just simply say before my colleagues testify that we are a very highly efficient, cost-effective, quality, and outcome-based service provider, and we want to be sure to be good stewards of the state resources, but in order to do that, we need to ask the state to reimburse the providers based on the cost to deliver services as is outlined in the Medicaid state plan. And along with its proposal that you're currently considering from the department to increase rates to physicians and radiologists at 75% of Medicare cost, we too would request that same consideration. I thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sean Matson, and I'm a nurse and manager for a home health agency in Portland. And what I'd like to do is tell you a couple of scenarios that are typical examples of some of the patients we serve and some of the challenges we have. One is regarding a 55-year-old woman who has multiple health problems, diabetes, wounds, mental health issues, and swollen legs, severely swollen legs. She was admitted to our agency for wound care. When she came from the hospital, she only had enough supplies to get so that one dressing change could be made. She had no medications when we admitted her. And though she had some money from her sister, she wasn't able to get to the bank. So we had to deal with that with diabetes and cardiovascular disease. These are very important to make sure she's taking her medications. She also was not getting food. She was not able to wash herself or take care of herself at home. So it was determined on admission that she needed to be placed in an assisted living facility. While we were working with DMAP to get that process approved, we had her on service for 2 months. Her wounds and her medical condition did improve. However, we were told from Salem that the patient needed a higher, that they would not give authorization for the patient to be in a higher level of care. And this was frustrating to us because we really felt that this was important for her. So we healed her wounds. She went home. 2 months later, she was readmitted to us, basically in the same situation she was the first time we admitted her. Wounds, serious medical situation. So on that second admission, we worked with her. We worked with her to get a caregiver in the home. She did accept one, Meals on Wheels. We were able to heal her wounds. During those months that we were taking care of her, those second 2 months, we did not receive authorization until after 2 months of providing service. The visits were finally authorized, but that's part of our big challenge, is how hard it is to get visits authorized. So for the first visit, we provided 20 nursing visits of physical therapy, occupational therapy, home health aid, and we spent over $5,000. We were reimbursed about $1,600. And the second admission, it's the same situation. So we had, for this patient alone, our costs beyond what we were paid were over $11,000. For the second scenario, it's similar. Patient who had a fall resulting in quadriplegia, providing many services. This patient needed nursing, physical therapy, occupational therapy. Patient wanted to stay at home, and we wanted to honor that choice. We ended up with having to provide daily nursing visits to take care of his wounds, and we ended up with an overall loss of $31,000 on this patient. The patient didn't have a caregiver in the home, so we needed to, for anyone to train, so that's why there were so many nursing visits. Again, it took us 2 to 3 months to get our services authorized. To wait 2 or 3 months to provide these services would have been incredibly detrimental to the patient. So we really feel that the home health payment methodology needs to be addressed immediately, and with that, the administrative processes need to be reviewed to facilitate more timely authorization. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Carter and members of the committee.
Don't be nervous.
Okay. I'm Judy Falkowski, and I'm a director of a home health agency hospital based in Coos Bay, Oregon. Just a little bit about the agency. We've been certified and licensed since 1977. I've been directing that program since 1982. I think that we have some opportunities and concerns right now because of our aging workforce, the regulatory requirements that continue to stretch our limited resources, and the cost to provide services, and especially as it relates to the state of Oregon reimbursing us for services for the high-risk, skilled need, Medicaid-eligible enrollees. What I'd like to do is go through a quick little snapshot for you of a client who we have on service currently. He was admitted to our services on March 16th. Home health works in 60-day episodes, so he will be on with us until May 14th. At this point, what happens when we go in and do our initial assessment, every discipline that's ordered does initial assessment. We put together a care plan, and from that we do projected visits. And from the projected visits to meet the care plan goals for this particular client, we figured we'd have 24 skilled visits from either an RN, a physical therapist, or an occupational therapist, and then we've given ourselves 7 as necessary visits, and that's for things that we can't control, like symptom management or delays in equipment or new caregivers that we need to train. At the current rate that we get paid for OHP, that would be $1,822 for this to carry from March 16th to May 14th. I'd like to go in a little bit of where we are right now. Now, if this client was a Medicare client, based on his clinical, functional, and utilization scores, we would be receiving $5,986.90. And the story for Oregon is that as home health providers, 18 months go for the cost reports, each of us are losing on an average of $400 an episode. So even though the Medicare episode is a lot larger than the $1,800 from OMAP, we're still, it takes some big risks. So I wanted to take an opportunity just to give you some really nitty-gritty about this client. Right now, the cost to the agency is, this client lives about 50 miles away from the agency, and so at reimbursing at 48.5 cents a mile, we're spending $24.28 just to visit this young man. The average time in the home, actually in the home, has been 87 minutes. That's, we've had 9 visits in 14 days, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about that. The average time to drive is 64 minutes, and that's because this is on a very rural road, very steep, one lane, lots of slides, and it's you have to go pretty slow at the last about 10 miles of it. The first 2 weeks this patient was on service, we averaged 231 minutes. And that was driving, our hands-on, our documenting, our telephone support, advocating, trying to get the documentation follow-up from multiple physicians and durable medical companies, and trying to do interdisciplinary conferencing so we're not duplicating services. The concerns at this point are just the truth. So let me tell you a little bit about this young man, because I probably went into way more detail than I needed to. On the back of my written documentation to you is a care plan, and that's a snapshot that we're hoping we're going to get when we took those first visits. But this is what actually happened those first 9 visits. So this client is homebound. He's a 32-year-old male. He came to us out of a rehab unit in Eugene. He was there from January 2nd, 07 to 3/15/07. And before that, he was hospitalized from 11/19. He sustained a traumatic brain injury, multiple fractures, and he's a C4-5 spinal cord injury resulting in quadriplegia. He developed a pneumonia and experienced a full cardio respiratory arrest November 25th. He was weaned off the ventilator in January. He still has some issues with dysphagia, difficulty swallowing, and he still has he's fragile as far as respiratory symptoms. He's homebound. He's difficult in taxing to leave the home. He's unable to ambulate. He requires assistance of 1 to 2 people. He's dependent on all activities of daily living. He's confined to a wheelchair. He's severely restricted with range of motion, and he has uncontrollable pain. He came to us with a 10-plus pain. He lives in a rural setting, 24 miles, 50 to 60 miles to travel to the agency. His support systems is a wife, 3 children from the ages of 2 to 9. The wife is unable to provide care at this time with the lifting due to her restrictions as a result of a high-risk pregnancy. And the client's mother lives close and is a primary coordinator of the care right now and is helping, and they have 3 paid caregivers. I'm going to pop down to the next page. So the highlights, the very first nursing visit, we discovered that the patient had only been home one day, and he was already starting to break down on his coccyx, and we had to really work about making sure they understood how important it was to get him turned. He wasn't getting turned at night. He has a daily wound to his left foot, and we placed some TV grip, which is a kind of a pressure compression, and we taught them about daily suprapubic catheter care, looked at his medications, and tried to advocate with a local physician around pain control. Second visit, his suprapubic was plugged, resulted in a 650cc symptom. Now, for you and I, that's not a big deal. You know, we get the urge at 150cc, a little shorter than a coffee cup. We can hold 1,000. But what happens with these spinal cord injuries, anything above the thoracic, you get exaggerated autonomic reflex, and it's life-threatening because the body goes into cardiac muscle, the smooth muscles, and your glands, and it's an emergency response the body has. You get very hypertensive, you get sweaty, and this is what happens when you are quad with the injury to the cervical area, and you have a little bit of fecal matter in your rectum, or you have 650cc in your bladder, and if it's not resolved, you can die from that. This family, I'm sure, had been taught, but they didn't understand how important that was. So we got up there, got a catheter, reinforced that they really need to straight cath. The mother knew how to do that. And we noticed they had a rash. He had a rash on his trunk, and he was reacting to Valium. We had called the physician, got discontinued, got a new med. Third visit was very lengthy because we're trying to do offloading, teaching, trying to really identify the autonomic dysreflexia to make sure that he doesn't end up in the hospital, which would cost, you know, probably at least $9,000 on the DRG he would go in on. And the fourth visit, the wife was able to do the suprapube cath, good technique. We're doing wound assessment, taking photos, doing some preventive stuff. The physical therapist was working on his first visit. We're working on contractures. We're working on a tilt wheelchair. We're looking at the pain because the positioning in his wheelchair was aggravating his shoulder pain, and looking at a home exercise program. If you go down the occupational therapist highlights, he was a transition from a rehab unit to home. Increased tone in upper extremities and elbow splints were not fitting well, and he was refusing to wear them. He could only stand them for 20 minutes. We readjusted the splints to eliminate the pressure points. Caregivers were trained with how to get the splints on and off. He has a mechanical lift with 4 points. So you have 4 places that help support you. This is a quad. He has no control of his body. It was not safe. So we've been advocating, we haven't got there yet, for a 6-point sling to have it be safe for his family and safe for him. We're also, he was trained at the rehab to use a power chair, and he has a splint for his right hand. However, he doesn't have a power chair at home. He's got a manual tilt space chair and a good sitting support, but he can't propel. And the way that the cushion was, it was causing more pain with his shoulders. And so we've advocated for that, and we've been able to get his pain under control. He's willing and able to at the care plan. We're getting our visits down. I think we're down to half of that 213 minutes. But this is a high-risk client for OMAP, and this is not unusual for us to see the intensity. So it's like home health isn't home health isn't home health. We make a big difference to very sick Oregonians who are in a hard place, who are needing assistance of the state. And I'm just concerned that with the limited resources, how long can we afford to provide this kind of care to these folks? He is at the right level of care. The referral came in December. We refused it at that time. This family is willing, and we think that we'll be able to be successful and discharge him in May, with them being able to manage him, and he will come on and off through the years if he has a breakdown or problem once we advocate for the right equipment, keep it simple, and give them the instructions to be at home. So with that, I would like you to really reconsider about the payment to home health providers. I think we are the cost-effective alternative for skilled care in the home for that 5% of the people that hit what we do best in that niche market. I thank you for your time.
And Chair. Thank you. Are you concerned about more adequate funding in general, or your reimbursement, or from
Vox? I'm looking at right now
your health, your capitated plan, who approves or disapproves?
I'm looking at right now it getting closer to my cost for the care we provide. Okay. And I hate doing my dirty laundry here, but last fiscal year it cost me $256 a visit. So for me to get $5 a visit on a case that's costing me so much, and as I'm looking at, I just shared with you, I've been in the agency 25 years.
Okay, that's my question specifically is this a disagreement between your capitated plan in reimbursement, or is this state funding?
This is state funding.
We are going to hear from your capitated plan shortly. And I was just wondering if there was a disagreement between you and that plan.
On the capitated plan, usually with young folks in this condition, they usually do not go to the capitated plan. And it's because they're seeing specialists on the I-5, and that's just what happens usually with these young quads. So this is an OMAP client.
Okay, one more question. And because I have great regard for your capitated plan.
Let me tell you, we have a management problem. Thank you very, very much. A management problem in that the committee wants to ask questions, and I want to hear from you as well. We will definitely start keeping you at 3 minutes so that everybody can have a chance to present with great respect. I respect your being here. So I'm going to have to ask you, if you have written information, please try to paraphrase and use as... use your 3 minutes and don't use somebody else's. Thank you so much. Mr. Murray, Bill Murray, and Pam Mason, and Cindy Becker. Is that the one for you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, Cindy Becker is not 100 miles away. These are just her clients, so she's going to have to keep it very short.
We've got our own newspapers.
You don't know that I'm not 100 miles away.
No, right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cindy Becker, and I'm the Executive Director of the Coalition for Healthy Oregon. I'm very pleased to be in this position. I've been with COHO for 3 months. The last time I came before you actually was when I was a Deputy Director for the Department of Human Services. So I've gone to the bright side, have that. I've gone to the bright side. I'm not going to speak from the written testimony. That was really provided for those members who don't know a lot about COHO. So just to give you some basic information, the Medicaid managed care plans serve approximately 70% of the OHP, the Oregon Health Plan population. They serve the current enrollment is 266,000 members. Approximately 60% of them are children. And there are the FCHIPs. You'll hear us talk about FCHIPs, which are the fully capitated health plans. They're the same as fully caps, FCHIPs, MCOs. Those are all referring to the same thing. I want to talk to you primarily about two issues, and they both deal with accountability. I've been at the hearings for the past few days, and I first of all want to thank the senators who have been very complimentary about the FCHIPs, and I appreciate the various issues that were brought up by Senators Winter, Gordley, and Carter around racial and ethnic disparity, around immunizations, around nutrition, and one pay for performance, and those are great things. The FCHIPs stepped up to the plate, first of all, when the commercial plans left the health plan. And they have been working very hard, and they've been working on good faith. And the way that the FCHIPs are paid is they are paid a per capita cost, per member per month cost, and it's capitated cost. And the statute requires that those per capita rates are developed by an actuary and are based on sound actuarial principles. I wish there was another actuarial. And so what happens in the budget process is the department contracts with Pricewaterhouse to develop these rates, and in their budget they submit those rates to the governor for inclusion in his budget, and those rates are at 100% of actuarial sound costs. The governor's budget came out and reduced those rates by 10%. The DRG rates for hospitals by 10%. The co-chair's budget came out and reduced them another 10%. So our question to this committee is, how can the FCHIPs operate with an actuarial sound budget when coming out of the gate it's reduced by 20%? Again, we are stepping up and we are doing what we have been asked to do. For the past 4 years, the FCHIPs rate for DRG hospitals has been reduced to 72%. Now, the rest of the medical costs of the medical community, and you're going to hear about this from Bill, those costs are continuing to rise. The FCHIPs, quite bluntly, sucked it up for the past few years. They can't keep doing that. The other issue speaks to standard population. As you know, the provider taxes from the FCHIPs and the hospitals, they underwrite the full cost of standard. You know that there used to be over 80,000 people on standard. The provider taxes fund an average of 24,000 individuals. An average means at the start of the year it's higher and at the end of the year it's lower. The current population on standard is 19,000 individuals, who, by the way, are the highest acuity. There is no balancer to them. So it is costing the FCHIPs an incredible amount of money. What's happening is, in standard population, the FCHIPs are bearing the risk. It was never our intent, nor the hospital association's intent, to be the sole underwriters of the standard population. It was always our understanding is when the state got out of its fiscal crisis that they would reinvest in the standard population. The governor's budget added 10,000 to 15,000 individuals. The co-chair's budget zeroed that out. So once again, the provider taxes are underwriting the entire standard population. We 100% support provider taxes. But if there are no provider taxes, there's no standard population. If there's no standard population, there's no OHP waiver. We believe the state As much as you all want us to be accountable, and we agree, the state needs to be accountable for its share. The state needs to invest in the standard population. The state needs to fund the plans at an actuarial sound rate. I will stop there. Any questions?
Madam Chair, may I?
Yes. Senator Morissette.
Thank you very much, and I agree totally. And, you know, as a member of the Health Care Reform Committee, I keep saying that you guys are the foundation of our plan, the future plan. And I think that it's very self-defeating to underfund you right now. And if you're not with us in this new plan, it's going to fail. But I applaud what you're doing. I think it's terrible that we don't have the funding at the present time. Whether or not we are able to get it, I don't know, but I certainly do support it.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Murray. I'm the CEO of Doctors of the Oregon Coast South, which is a fully capitated health plan that operates in Coos County. I'm also a member of COHO, which Cindy just spoke to you about. What you have before you, and in 3 minutes, I'm going to try and explain a chart that you have in front of you that tries to depict a very complicated process with regards to rates and funding. And what you have in front of you is a summary of the last four bienniums, including a projection for the budget for 07-09. And on that chart, you have a comparison of three items. The first bar for each biennium is the actual funded rate, and that's the average per member per month rate for that two-year biennium. The second bar is what the actuary, the state's independent actuary, PricewaterhouseCoopers, said the rate should be to be actuarially sound. The third bar, which actually starts in 03-05, is really taking the 01-03 rate and applying to that the growth rate in commercial insurance premiums. And that really is the market rate that's out there. So what you see is stair steps that grow farther and farther apart as we move out to 07-09. And you see a vast difference between what a rate is or would have been had it been sustained at the same rate as the growth in commercial insurance premiums compared to what the actuary calculated and then what actually has been recommended to be funded. So it goes to the point that Cindy made just a minute ago about we can sustain this program for a period of time, but it gets harder and harder and harder to do. And I don't like using the word funding or money. What really this is a discussion about is access to care, because we have to be able to contract, encourage, promote providers to participate in this program so that we can provide access to care. As a fully capitated health plan, we guarantee access to care. That's a requirement of our contract. Under the fee-for-service side, there is no such guarantee that an individual have access to care. So funding for us is actually access to care. We have some concerns, and we have worked closely, much more closely this period, with the department on the actuarial calculation that's done by PricewaterhouseCoopers. The one thing that you'll notice is that actuary line bar goes up, goes down, goes up, goes down, which actually makes no sense from a market perspective when you have costs that go up every year. They don't go up and down and up and down. So we have worked with the department and continue to work with the department over concerns we have with the actual actuarial calculation. We still need to do a lot of work in that area and are continuing to work towards that. But the overall message here is it is actually getting harder and harder to convince providers to stick with this program. In 05-07, we actually incurred a real decrease in the actual dollars per member per month. It was a decrease in what we have available to pay to providers to encourage them to continue to participate in this program. I wanted to also say a minute and a half of my time to talk about the fact that as managed care plans across the state, we provide a lot of the additional services that have been talked about in these hearings the last couple of days. Those are all value-added services that may or may not even be covered by the Oregon Health Plan, but as plans in our communities, we analyze on a day-to-day basis and look for cost benefits. So a number of plans provide nutritional counseling, weight management programs, those type of things that aren't really covered per se, but if we can help manage weight, manage nutrition, and offset the cost of a complicated diabetes case or other cases, prenatal care is another area we invest heavily in, immunizations, trying to get all of that done, that is something we do every day. And I want to thank you, I want to thank the department for allowing us to do that in our communities, because we have made a difference. We want to continue to be around to make a difference as we move forward. So I would accept any questions now that you have.
Senator Marcel.
I do have a question. But before I have a question, I want to restate what I said a few minutes ago for the benefit of the co-chair of the Reform Committee, that you are the foundation of the new system. And we have to make sure that you survive. How do you account for the variation in the actuarial in 0507, the up and down?
In 3 minutes or less, it's a very difficult, complicated process that's become more and more complicated, that actual calculation. And it is something that I think Dr. Goldberg and the department have acknowledged has become overly complicated. And it's also been vested in PricewaterhouseCoopers to do that calculation. So it's been somewhat of a black box. I know the department wants to be more involved to have a better understanding of that process. There needs to be more clarity in that process. And we are working with the department on that. But if you stand back and look at this, these rates make no sense to me. And part of the process is that they're forecasting out a very long period of time. So it's a difficult process for an actuary. I don't want to demean that process at all, but the overall result does not make sense. Everybody knows that insurance costs and the cost of health care, that inflation is rising at a much faster rate than general inflation. So the overall results here are confusing to us and don't make sense. And in order to be around as plans, what we need to do is have some sense of stable funding and expectation over a longer period of time. It's really hard all of a sudden on January 1st to have a 17% reduction in your rates from where it was the prior December 31st.
Ms. Leeson.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator, members of the committee, my name is Pam Marion Mason from CARE Oregon, and I'm going to speak briefly today to reiterate a little of what you heard and explain why Cindy calls us the bright side. We really are proud of the work we do, and most of the fully capitated health plan staff have been with those organizations, as you may know, for a very long period of time, some of us longer than we want to admit. We are proud of the work we do in our communities. I think it's important to point out that what Bill was telling you is a very real problem at CARE Oregon. We have seen a $5.5 million reduction this year, and we're going to see another $12 million projected reduction for next year, which is about, you can do the math, $22.5 million in rate reductions that we're seeing. And we are fortunately in a position where we've been very wise about being able to reserve for that. In the short term, we can handle it, but in the long term, we can't. And we have been there, done that, and those of you who have been around as long as we have will remember what that looks like. So I'm just here to reiterate how, no matter how well we manage, if the state doesn't do their piece and give us sufficient rates, we're not going to be able to sustain what we do and the work we do, and we're, like I said, very proud of that. Right now in our standard population, we are spending on average every dollar we're getting and then a little bit more to take care of those members. So we are paying out in benefits the money we're getting in plus a little bit more, which doesn't leave anything for administrative costs, and we're working on that. You know, we're spreading that cost around. But when you're a Medicaid plan and you can't raise premiums or raise copays or do any of that sort of thing to help offset that. That makes it more difficult. And I would just add, too, that when we work with our providers, fortunately, most of us have had long-term relationships with those folks as well, it does get increasingly difficult to explain how rate reduction translates into what we're able to pay them. And those conversations get increasingly complex, as you might imagine. So we're very interested in staying in the game. We love this. We would love to see both standard fully funded again, but at least actuarially sound rates, please. That's how we can continue to thrive and provide the access that we do for our communities.
If I could add one analogy, which I thought was a great one because I could understand it, it's like if your employer came to you and said, you know, had a bad year, so we're gonna have to cut your salary. You can't go to your landlord and say, sorry, but can you please cut the rent? It doesn't work that way. So we still have to pay, the FCHIP still have to pay their providers. They can't pass along those types of rate reductions to the providers and have to figure out a way to make that work, and it's becoming increasingly hard to do that.
Thank you very much.
Ellen Yell, please.
Sean Baird and Dave LaPoff, is that right?
Come on up while Ms. Lowe is coming. The two of you can come up.
Just welcome. Chair Carter and members of the committee. I'm Ellen Lowe, community advocate for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and it's on behalf of Oregon's 57 acute care community hospitals, health care systems, and the patients they serve that I testify today to encourage you to begin the process of rehabilitating the Oregon Health Plan. So it will be there for the patients we are called to serve. While the governor's budget is a modest start in that renewal, the co-chair's budget does not honor past commitments to vulnerable and poor Oregonians, to the federal government, to providers, and to advocacy groups. The hospitals support the proposed tobacco tax and the essential health services scheduled for its funding. We wish to particularly highlight increase in enrollment in the Oregon Health Plan standard. Cindy Becker has told you that enrollment is now lower than 20,000. My memory is that it was once 102,000. These adults who should be covered are under 100% of the federal poverty level. When Oregon sought the waivers for the Oregon Health Plan, the capacity to serve this population, as well as the categorically eligible groups, was a major factor in our receiving those waivers. I should add that this commitment was also with national as well as local health-related advocacy groups and with health service providers and purchasers. I participated in many, many conference calls and direct negotiations because I was on the Health Services Commission during this time. In negotiations where we were seeking support or at least neutrality with some of these local groups and some of the national groups. Now, the name of the federal agency has changed, but they still remember that commitment that we made. Your budget briefing book says that the centers would likely view with favor any standard expansion. Now, likewise, we believe that CMS would view with alarm Oregon's continued disinvestment in Standard. And Cindy said it well, there are no state general fund dollars funding the Standard program in Oregon. Now, the hospital provider tax actually was originally advanced by the hospitals to honor another commitment in Senate Bill 27, and that was to reimburse providers at cost. But in the depth of that recent recession, the hospitals agreed to offer these funds to receive federal match, so a fraction of the standard population could be maintained, the program. Now, Oregon's no longer in a recession, so CMS may not look so kindly that are continuing to ignore the expansion population that justified that original waiver. Expanding Standard is also critical to the Oregonians living in poverty who need timely, appropriate care. I've attached a bar chart which comes from your briefing book. I ask you to particularly note that the families who are on TANF, they're down at 46% of the federal poverty level. But Standard goes up to 100%. So there was a time when we were responding to families with health care, even though they were not on the TANF program. And the other thing I know that we call hearing and testimony before you is that when adults have access to health insurance, they're more likely to provide care for their children. So many of these adults who were part of Standard actually had children, and then the children were also then enrolled in other parts of the Oregon Health Plan. The adults who were in this plan then were receiving preventive maintenance. When that went away, I would say that the emergency rooms in Oregon hospitals have become the medical homes, and that is not cost effective at all. Also remember that mental health and chemical dependency programs are part of the Oregon Health Plan. When we said Oregon Health Plan, we included all parts of health services. And so as you review the costs to the judicial system, the correction system, to housing programs, to your not-for-profit agencies in your communities, I do believe that you will see that Standard is an investment with dividends. I've also listed the other programs that hospitals are part of in the governor's budget for funding from the tobacco tax, because the current underfunding, and you have heard, because both from Mr. Murray and Ms. Becker, that these really do relate to those reimbursement rates. It goes across all of us as providers, that they threaten the stability, the capacity of those community responses. The other thing that I wish to mention is that Oregon hospitals, because they are probably the most cost effective, the most efficient in the nation, no good deed goes unpunished, and so that's what puts our Medicare reimbursement rate almost at the bottom. And so that is another issue which contributes to our current problems. I'd like to acknowledge the questions of all of you on this committee, because I've been in that back row watching your deliberations, because I think you really have sensed the connection, the linkage that is between what we're doing within the now the Division of Medical Assistance Programs and costs in other part of the department, as well as the state and well as our community. And I also wish to acknowledge that what I've heard from this division is a recognition that what they are doing now in their conversations within their division, within the whole department, and with their state and local partners, because to look at the costs of health care without looking at the costs of not providing it and all these other parts of Oregon that make us a very great place to live if we have adequate funding is really not very wise. It becomes that penny wise and very pound foolish kind of approach that we've too often have.
And you know, I hate to stop you, don't you?
Pardon?
You know, I hate to stop you, don't you?
Yes. I just want to thank you for being part of what I hope will be a very creative, constructive process. Thank you, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you very much.
Chair.
Yes, nicely this time.
Okay.
I just want to respond a little bit to Ellen Lowe's comments. And first of all, acknowledge not only her work in the
Absolutely.
Original creation of the Oregon Health Plan, and certainly now carried on by Care Oregon, Pam Nason's here with us, and Bill Murray from DOCS. This is really a uniquely Oregon creation that unfortunately and unjustifiably has come under some criticism and critique in recent years that the Oregon Health Plan just isn't working. And you look at, you know, just the numbers, and on the numbers you go, yeah, we're not covering additional eligibles as was originally contemplated. But the important thing to remember is that A, we have this fabulous medical delivery infrastructure in place, almost with complete 100% geographic representation throughout the state. And they do incredible and important work. The other thing to keep in mind is, you know, when we hear these criticisms, please remember this old analogy. It's kind of like, you know, if you don't put enough gas in the tank of your car, don't blame the vehicle for not getting you to where you want to go. This is a funding issue where we have not properly funded one of the most effective and efficient delivery systems in the country. That is not just this committee's fault. That is our fault as a people. And Ellen tagged a little bit on to the economic value of covering more Oregonians, and I know you agree, all Oregonians. It's more than an economic issue. It's a moral issue as well, and our responsibility for taking care of our fellow brothers and sisters. Ellen, thank you and all of you in the audience that do such noble work. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sean Baird. I'm a paramedic and the owner of Woodbine Ambulance Service, and I'm also speaking today for the Oregon State Ambulance Association. I'm here to point out, I guess, the somewhat critical condition that ambulance service providers are finding themselves at this year. Since 2001, we've seen our Medicare reimbursement cut by over 40% in Oregon. We have relatively flat Medicaid reimbursement. We've had the elimination of the state motor vehicle accident fund entirely, and we're seeing a significant rise in the number of completely uninsured patients. We are at a point where our ability to cost shift onto the few commercially insured patients that we see just isn't there anymore. We provide service 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every single day, all across the state of Oregon, within a few minutes of somebody calling 911. We don't stop and ask whether you have insurance coverage or if you are going to pay or not pay or anything else. We're on the way there, and we deliver life-saving care within minutes of when you call. With that, when 70% of our patients are Medicaid, Medicare, and we get reimbursed less than half of cost, we're stretched pretty thin to be able to continue to do that without having to cut back significantly. I looked at last week, I picked a day, Monday, and looked at 24 hours in Woodburn of what emergency calls we had. We had 14, which we provided advanced level of care and transport to. 8 of those were Medicare, 4 Medicaid, 1 totally uninsured, and 1 patient with commercial insurance. It's just not sustainable to continue to provide the level of care we're providing with that patient mix, and we certainly can't balance that mix out by any control of our own. So we're here today asking that we're asking for $467,000 as a sort of directed to emergency ambulance transportation in the DMAP budget to help us balance out some of the losses that we've had to take over the last couple of years and keep up with the costs that were additional fuel, pharmaceuticals, personnel, et cetera, that are putting pressure on us.
One question.
Yes.
Did you say you've been reduced about 40% in
life? From Medicare. Yeah.
And what period?
Since 2001. Our most recent decrease was 8% that went into effect January 1st.
And members of the committee, Madam Chair, good afternoon. My name is Dave Lapoff. I am a volunteer with Kaiser Fire District, a past president of the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association, and I wanted to put a fire service face on what Mr. Baird just talked about. While he represents the private entities, there's a lot of fire-based transport agencies throughout the state. Salem Fire, they contract with a private fire, Turner Fire District, my fire district, Kaiser Sisters, Bend Fire District. All those fire districts are in the same situation as far as the Medicare fee reduction, as well as transporting more OMAP patients than Medicaid, Medicare patients. But there's also the volunteer component of the agencies that don't transport. I'll use Cloverdale Fire District in Central Oregon. They don't transport patients, but they get their EMS training from Sisters and Bend Fire who do transport. And so if these agencies have their funding from the transport side, they can offer more training opportunities to the volunteer agencies. That's the same process that happens down in Applegate, happens over in Canby. A number of agencies that don't transport see the benefit. I know Mr. Baird's agency provides training to agencies outside that don't transport, Silverton, Mount Angel. So it's a much more larger system when you start looking at where these dollars go to. I've heard a lot of people speak today about enormous problems. Pre-hospital medicine, ambulance transport is really the gateway to all of those facilities. She was just talking about the hospital base and the ERs. Those patients generally come by ambulance, some private vehicles, obviously, but we are, by and large, the way people get inside the system. We have no options. We turn our wheels on. We get called, we have to go. Maybe we transport, maybe we don't, but we're using those resources of time and fuel and money and equipment. So I just wanted to kind of give a little view of that. And certainly answer any questions that you might have.
I appreciate your work.
Just one quick comment, and while I don't disagree one iota with what our two EMT fire service individuals have said, Mr. Baird, and excuse me, I've forgotten your name, and it was referred to as the ambulance system, the transport system, as the gateway, and that is certainly true, but it begs the question of gateway to what? And I think, and maybe Ellen can help me out here just a little bit, in terms, there's only 17 trauma hospitals, and this is a voluntary, you know, assumption that hospitals involve themselves with, and it's the trauma system in this entire state is perhaps the most fragile of anything we address in terms of the surgeons and the nurses and the anesthetists and those that are on call for forever, you know, and not, you know, getting the wages and the reimbursement that, you know, is needed to keep them in this state. It's just not getting them there. It's what are you getting them to? And very, this system is on life support, not to coin a medical term. That's something we as a committee have to be very concerned about as well.
Absolutely.
Madam Chair, if I can follow up on that. And Madam Chair, Senator Russell, excellent question. We always hear about trauma hospitals and the large facilities, the critical access facilities throughout the state. Pioneer Hospital and Morrow and Umatilla facilities. So there's a large number of agencies that don't even get the recognition. So you're completely right that the system as a whole needs a good looking at. So thank you for that opportunity.
I appreciate very much the three of your testimonies. Thank you.
Chair Carter, may I just respond?
I love when you respond. We still have three more people.
Just to say that, Senator Westland, I think you put your finger on something, that this is a system-wide problem, and so it affects all of us who at one time or another are dependent upon a health system, and so it's public, private, tax exempt. It's all of us. And so that's why a solution in this building is going to impact what I pay for my health insurance, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. John Mullen, Mary Beth Healy, and Melissa Rash or Nash? Rash, I think.
Madam Chair, if I may also, there's some testimony, an article about dentistry that Cedric Hayden had asked me to handle with your permission.
Sure. Okay. I mispronounced the name, but it's Fred Meyer. Oh, sweetie. I see. Okay. All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen from the Oregon Law Center. I'll be very brief. I know the time is short. Basically, the Oregon Law Center, of course, works on behalf of low-income people statewide. As you might imagine, issues about health care access are really major concerns to our partners as well as to the clients that we serve. This has been a great session for a variety of reasons, talking about things like healthy kids, addition to Oregon Health Plan Standard, and also the health care reform discussion that I've been attending most Mondays and Wednesday nights. I guess just to make a couple of very quick points, whatever else is done this session, I certainly hope that there will be some additions back to OHP standard. That's of immediate concern, even though the discussions that are going on Monday, Wednesday night are really vital to the discussion. Hopefully we can do some things that are really very immediate with adding some people back to OHP standard. I want to draw your attention to a couple of populations very quickly. We had a very good hearing this morning in Human Services Women's Wellness Committee this morning. Representative Kotek was there. We talked about general assistance. It's my hope that this committee will also consider reestablishing the general assistance program, and along with that, the health care that goes with it. General assistance clients were OHP plus clients in the past. But it also illustrates the fact that there are people out there that are not getting general assistance because the program was eliminated, but those people are out there and they have health care needs. So here again is another reason for taking a look at OHP standard. There's another population that I want to draw your attention to, and those are the people that get Social Security disability benefits that have a two-year waiting period for Medicare and in most instances are not eligible for other health care coverage. These are people, and oftentimes there are women who have had worked the required number of quarters, get a disability check, makes them low income, but in many instances they'd even be above the level of OHP standard if it was open and available to them. So with all of that, I would just say that, again, appreciate the discussion that's been going on down here this session. And unlike other Wednesday nights, this Wednesday night I'll be in my hometown of Oregon City to meet with the Ways and Means Committee. And I know that there are so many pressing concerns that you are facing because I've been here virtually every day that you've been meeting. And I think among all of those pressing concerns, I hope that we can make some real progress on health care this session. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great job, John. Chair Carter, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk today regarding 5031. My name is Mary Beth Healy. I'm the Executive Director of Oregonians for Health Security, and we're a statewide healthcare advocacy organization that's been working to improve access to quality and affordable and secure healthcare for Oregonians since 2002. And, you know, it's been said, many of the members of the committee have said it themselves, with the high cost of healthcare really does impact us all. And I would like to just share a couple of stories of some Oregonians who depend on the Oregon Health Plan for their lives, quite frankly. You heard from Ellie earlier. One is a woman whose name is Heather Erickson, and she's been on the Oregon Health Plan since she was 17 years old. Probably actually really predated Oregon Health Plan as we know it today. And she's very concerned that there is not in the co-chair's budget the resources to fund OHP standards. She's seen many, many changes in the Oregon Health Plan in the 17, 18 years that she's been receiving services from the state of Oregon, and she wanted me to express that to you. She has Crohn's disease, fibromyalgia, and possibly lupus as well, and she really depends on the Oregon Health Plan and worries about other colleagues and friends of hers that need health care services as well. One other family is Vern and Cheryl Smith. This is a story of Oregon's recession and recovery. Vern and Cheryl were both on the Oregon Health Plan. Both were not working, and then Cheryl got a job in 2004 after the recession started picking up a little bit. Her employer did not offer health insurance, and Vern was not working. He's got many chronic illnesses. And when they went to reapply to the Oregon Health Plan in November of 2004, Cheryl made $20 too much for them to still qualify for the health plan. And so Vern lost all of his health services. He ended up in the hospital in 3 months. He was in the hospital three times, the last time for a heart attack. This family now has over $100,000 worth of medical bills that add stress to them, in addition to the fact that they're not getting the health care services that they need. 2006, it's actually looking a little bit better for them. Vern has now qualified for Social Security and disability, so at least he is eligible for Medicare now. But the issue is still the same for them, and the stress that they went through not being able to access their stories. And there are hundreds of thousands of stories like that that shows that our investment in health care really makes sense, not only on the moral and fiscal grounds, but frankly as an economic boom for this state. Before the recession, as others have said today, there are over 100,000 Oregonians on the Oregon Health Plan. The population has dwindled to less than 20,000 now. We're very concerned that if there is not a state commitment to the Oregon Health Plan standard population, that we could very well lose the funding that is currently funding that program through of the provider taxes.
May I have you to wrap
yes.
up, please?
Yes, and so my thing, just to say thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you,
is
Madam
that
Chair.
For every, thank you, Senator Westman, for every $1 million, this is for the money people, for every $1 million that we invest in health care programs in our state, we recoup $3.1 million in business-related activity. We are all paying, as people who likely have health insurance in this room, over $1,100 a year to cover the uninsured. That hidden health tax could probably be most better used investing in public health programs, reinvesting in the standard programs so that people like Heather and Jason and Vern and Cheryl can get the health care services they need. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Colleagues, I would appreciate your being patient, and let's hear our next three panelists, and that will go over your time. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Gary Oxley, Oxley & Associates, appearing before you this afternoon representing Fred Meyer, Safeway, and Rite Aid. With me on this panel is Sean Miller, who is representing National Association of Chain Drug Stores, and Melissa Rash, who is a pharmacist at Fred Meyer. We appreciate you allowing us an opportunity to testify. We will be quick. We want to address the issue of the average manufacturer price that was addressed yesterday during the course of this hearing and the impact that that is having on community and retail pharmacies across the state of Oregon and across the United States. I think there was perhaps a misrepresentation made yesterday in terms of the impact on retail pharmacies, chains, and community pharmacies across the state, and we would like to address that and set the record straight. So if we may, Madam Chair, I'd like Sean Miller to begin with some comments, followed by Melissa, and I'd like to close with a comment.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent Community Pharmacy, which are chain pharmacies that are impacted by the average manufactured price change. And what we mean by that, just a little background very quickly, is we are the reimbursement rate has been based on an average wholesale price. It's been based on that for quite some time. I think prior to 2002, we were at AWP minus 11%. We've gone up to AWP minus 15%. Our dispensing fee is $3.50. Congress, in the Federal Deficit Reduction Act, recently passed legislation that changes our reimbursement rate on generics only. And what I mean by that, they change from AWP to AMP, average manufacturer price. The average manufacturer price is supposed to be very close to our acquisition costs. And so again, if you're changing from generics only to a more accurate acquisition cost, you're leaving AWP on brands and keeping the dispensing fee the same, $3.50, there is essentially not an incentive for our pharmacies to dispense generic drugs, which I think is should be a policy of this committee and a policy of our state. And so again, the federal change, when that federal change occurred at the federal level, there was no requirement that states and the Medicaid departments actually adjust their dispensing fees accordingly. So again, keeping the $3.50 the same, there's, you know, for us to be whole from the standpoint of our businesses, we would have to probably go up to somewhere around $10, $11, just to be made whole in this change of reimbursement. What we are asking the committee is to at least have us work with the department to figure out what that change in the reimbursement rate is, because if we don't get a change in that reimbursement rate, again, there's no incentive, and there won't be the incentive for us to dispense drugs because the change in this policy. And so we wanted the committee to be aware of this federal change because it impacts the decisions, I think, the potentially the budget decisions that you all make in this committee. Again, Madam Chair, I appreciate the opportunity for us to at least express these concerns, and at this point I'll turn it over to Melissa Rash, who's a pharmacist with Fred Meyer. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank you for coming at the last minute. I know all about that, so thank you.
Well, it was kind of hectic trying to get another pharmacist in so I could run down here, but I made it, and I thank you for the opportunity to allow me to speak. My name is Melissa Rash, and I am a practicing pharmacist with Fred Meyer. And I just want to reiterate what Sean said, that I'm concerned that as a pharmacist, if we go with this AMP and we don't increase the dispensing fee, we're going to see nothing but a negative impact on all pharmacies, whether you are a chain pharmacy, an independent pharmacy, a rural pharmacist, or a pharmacist that works in the city. We will not be able to practice at our highest standard just because we will have these cuts. I think it's very important that, like Sean said, where is our incentive to dispense generics if it's going to cost us actually less to dispense the brand? I don't see the cost savings in that. I think that this dispensing fee, the rate, does need to be looked at. Just so we can continue to, you know, be as cost effective as we can. So that's it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Marchette.
Yeah, who, do we have a choice? Is this a federal law change?
Well, what can we do? Madam Chair, Senator Marchette, you don't have a choice in what the reimbursement of average manufacturer price, the federal government set that.
Yeah.
What they did leave open and what most states are doing because of that, and I think it is a policy to try to get more dispensing of generic drugs, the only choice you have to do to adjust the reimbursement is to adjust the dispensing fee.
So
you don't have a choice in AMP, you have a choice on the dispensing fee.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, I would just conclude by saying it's definitely a benefit to the state to have the opportunity to ensure that the patients have the opportunity of getting generic drugs as opposed to a brand drug. And I would also remind the committee, or those of you who have been here for past sessions, that in the 01-03 biennium, retail pharmacy agreed to an AWP adjustment of 15% with the understanding that in the next biennium there would be a rollback to AWP minus 14%. That never occurred. We are still, as Mr. Miller indicated, operating at the AWP minus 15% level. So we are working from a negative advantage right out of the chute, and a serious consideration of that reimbursement rate would be greatly appreciated by not only chains but community and small independent pharmacies in rural Oregon.
Let me tell you what I want to have happen. I want the two of you, along with Mr. Edge, to coordinate some time between with John for my schedule, and we can have further conversation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Members of the committee, thank you.
Excuse me, one other point. That would include the new prescription drug purchasing pool, right? Reimbursement rate. Dispensing fee. Think about it.
Think about that. Okay.
Yeah.
Marcet knows how to stir stuff in the game at the last minute.
Well, it's an
important No, I don't mean to minimize that. I'm just teasing. Yeah.
No,
that
I know, but that is an important point.
Okay. Thank you very, very much, and committee is dismissed.